ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Tuesday, the 16th of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, fiery exchange. Supermarket bosses front a Senate inquiry amid allegations of price gouging. And the youth curfew lifts in Alice Springs, but what next for young people in a town that struggled with violence and juvenile crime?
We've got to come up with programs and services that can remain as a baseline regardless of election cycles. Until we can do that, we're always going to be looking for the next circuit breaker.
First today, a stabbing at a church in Sydney's southwest overnight has been declared a terrorist incident. Assyrian faith leader Bishop Mar-Mari Emanuel was presiding over a service when he was allegedly attacked by a 16-year-old boy. Another worshipper was also injured. Police say the attack was motivated by religious extremism. Alison Schau reports.
Captured on live stream, a 16-year-old boy lunges at a Syrian Orthodox Christian priest, Bishop Mar-Mari Emanuel. Police say the 53-year-old bishop is lucky to be alive after suffering lacerations to his head in the stabbing. It's now been declared an act of terrorism.
The things that influenced my decision to declare this a terrorist incident was the actions of the individual.
Here's New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb.
We will allege attended that church armed with a knife and stabbed the bishop. We believe there are elements that are satisfied in terms of religious motivated extremism.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says a joint counter-terrorism task force has been established, including New South Wales Police, the Australian Federal Police and domestic spy agency ASIO.
This is a disturbing incident. There is no place for violence in our community. There is no place for violent extremism. We are a peace-loving nation.
It's the second major stabbing in the city in less than a week. Six people died after a man attacked people at Bondi Junction on Saturday. Anthony Albanese says despite the recent incidents, the country is an overwhelmingly harmonious society.
I understand that people are feeling uneasy. It is vital, in my view, that we continue to stress what unites us and that respect for each other be maintained at all times.
ASIO Director General Mike Burgess says the terror threat level in Australia will remain at possible, but the domestic spy agency will be investigating whether others were involved in yesterday's attack at the church.
Our job is also to look at individuals connected with the attacker to assure ourselves that there is no one else in the community with similar intent. At this stage, we have no indications of that.
Mr. Burgess explains that this incident, unlike the Bondi mass murder, is being called an act of terrorism because of evidence that it is religiously or ideologically motivated. Authorities won't reveal the religious background of the 16-year-old alleged attacker or whether he was radicalised online. Extremism expert Dr. Josh Roos from Deakin University says it's difficult to speculate about his motivations until a thorough police investigation.
We know that it does match the profile of some international recent events. There was a plot, for example, to attack churches in the US over the last couple of weeks that was uncovered. But we just don't know. To that extent, we do rely on the police to be transparent and to feed that information through when they can.
The state's police commissioner, Karen Webb, is also condemning the riots that broke out on the street outside the Wakeley Church after the stabbing.
The crowd turned on police. That is unacceptable, and those that were involved in that riot can expect a knock at the door. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but we will find you and we will come and arrest you.
One police officer is in hospital with a broken jaw after a brick was thrown at his face, while dozens of police vehicles were damaged. Local residents say they're shocked and horrified.
A church is the safest place in the world, you would think. When I saw what they'd done to the police cars and that this morning, there's no need for anybody to treat police in a bad way. It is absolutely disgusting.
Total chaos. Uncalled for, unnecessary.
People
running, screaming, calling for blood.
Independent federal member for the area, Dai Lee, says she's worried that labelling the attack terrorism could increase community tensions.
To go so quickly to declare that in a community like ours, I am very concerned for the safety. It's actually doing the opposite. You're not going to be able to create cohesion with those language and those words.
New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has called for calm and warned against any acts of retaliation.
There is no such thing in Australia in taking the law into your own hands. It doesn't exist. You will be met by the full force of the law if there's any attempt for tit-for-tat violence in Sydney over the coming days.
That's the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, there, ending that report from Alison Shaw. Well, community leaders are also calling for calm in the wake of the terrorist incident at the Assyrian Orthodox Church in southwestern Sydney. Peter Dukas is chair of the Ethnic Communities Council of New South Wales.
Look, it's very important, Sally. I mean, this is an isolated incident. We still are, in Australia, blessed with being the most successful multicultural community in the world, and our communities and our diversity is our strength. So I don't think this is reflective of our community or our community values. The Assyrian community that was affected is one of our members and one of our is one of the pillars of our multicultural community, and I call to them and all those affected to allow the authorities to do their job and see through to the end of this event.
Can you understand the level of distress within that community at the moment, given what unfolded last night?
Absolutely. The images are shocking. Hearts go out to those people affected, especially given that it was a religious leader who was directly impacted. I've met His Grace, and he's a huge community leader, not only in the Assyrian community, but around Australia. He has a massive social media presence. But ultimately, this is not reflective of our society. This is a single isolated incident. We have the New South Wales Police investigating this, also whether it is a terrorist event. I would call all communities to let the authorities do their job and to band together. And that's what we do in Australia.
How strong do you think that the intercommunity, interfaith organisations are, and how important do you think their role will be in a situation like this to keep some kind of calm?
I've been in this job as the chair of the ECC for quite a while. If we say, and if as government says, that our communities and our diversity are our strength, that government will turn to those communities as part of the response.
How difficult is it to manage some of these things when particularly it's around issues of faith, when people feel very, very strongly about that, and to be in a place of peace, to be in a religious service and this to happen? Do you understand the strength of feeling behind that for some people?
Absolutely, and it's terrifying. You expect to be able to attend a church or any religious event and be safe and at peace. To have this occur is a horrifying thing. We must look at this as what it is, as an isolated incident, something that is not reflective of our wider community. And the authorities are doing their job in investigating what occurred and what led to this incident. The community response, that's what I would take out of this. Obviously, it's a time for us all to band together, to work together. And I understand it's already happening. So many of my members have already contacted us in ways that they can reach out and to assist the Assyrian community that's been affected.
Peter, you've been involved in this kind of work for a long time. How would you describe to people how much hard work is put in behind the scenes on the quiet days when there aren't incidents like this to build those networks and build that trust and cooperation so that if there is an incident, those lines of communication are already open amongst communities and between the communities and the government as well?
It's a good question, Sally. Multiculturalism in Australia is something that we are used to now. But it was never like that. And I always call it a gift that was given to us by Malcolm Fraser and Gough Whitlam. And it's a stewardship that we all have to preserve. And it is something that has created the modern Australia. And it is central to not only us being a harmonious society, but also our place in the world and the way that we see ourselves.
That's Peter Dukas there, the chair of the Ethnic Communities Council of New South Wales. This is The World Today. It's been a blistering morning for Woolworths Chief Executive Brad Banducci, who's been questioned over alleged price gouging in the face of the cost of living crisis. A Senate inquiry into supermarket prices has contested the company's claims of just how profit is measured, with Mr. Banducci warned that he could be held in contempt and even face sanctions for not answering questions. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the inquiry. We spoke a short time ago. Peter, good afternoon. How did Brad Banducci perform given his walkout from a Four Corners interview earlier this year? and now facing hostile questioning from the Senate committee.
Well, Sally, Brad Banducci was doing his best to be calm and measured, and unlike that Four Corners interview, he wasn't wearing the Woolworths name badge, dressed casually, no tie, a white shirt, a dark jacket. He was clearly prepared for fireworks, and Committee Chairman Green Senator Nick McKim went in hard right from the start, delivering on expectations.
In the past decade, you've put the squeeze on your suppliers, including farmers, to force down wages, to compromise staff safety and to price gouge your customers. Countless Australians are skipping meals, dumpster diving and eating less healthy food because they can't afford to buy food and groceries. How can you possibly deny that you are using your market dominance to do over farmers, to do over workers and to price gouge your shoppers?
We disagree with that position. This is an incredibly competitive market. If you look at our numbers, and we've submitted many numbers, you will see a business that makes a 10% return on capital. In the face of all of those facts, it's very hard to say that we are price gouging.
That's our Woolworths Chief Executive Brad Banducci, grilled by the Green Senator Nick McKim, who took issue with that figure of 10% return on investment. Senator McKim seized on another measure of profitability, return on equity, which is much higher at 26%. And in an exchange that went on for the best part of 2 hours, Brad Banducci pushed back on that measure, refused to accept it. Senator McKim accused Mr. Banducci of PR spin and that he was trying to cover up an uncomfortable 26% figure.
A first-year commerce student at university could calculate your return on equity. Isn't it the fact that that figure, 26%, in a year where you made $1.7 billion in profits, shows that your company is making off like bandits and effectively has a license to print money because you are actually providing goods to the Australian people that they can't do without. You operate in a captive market and people have to eat.
Senator, with due respect, we focus on our return on investment.
All right, I know what you focus on. Thank you, Mr. Banducci. I know what you focus on. We're not interested in PR spin. We're not interested in you kind of bullshitting your way through this committee. We are interested in you answering the questions.
Well, Sally, at one point, the committee chairman, Nick McKim, repeatedly warned Brad Banducci that he could be held in contempt and face 6 months jail time, potentially. But under a lot of pressure, Mr. Banducci reluctantly conceded that he actually didn't know the return on equity number, didn't focus on it, but he agreed to take the question on notice. Then, as expected, Senator McKim said, how could a CEO on $8.4 million a year not know the return on equity figure? So, Sally, a painful game of gotcha that's done little to help Brad Banducci's profile and reputation, and he must be looking forward to his retirement later on this year.
That's Peter Ryan there. As the dust settles after yesterday's bombshell court decision in the Bruce Lehrman defamation case, there are questions over the adequacy of Australia's defamation laws. Some groups are calling for reform, worried that Australia's legal framework continues to silence women. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
It was a defamation case spanning the media, the legal profession and politics, unlike any in recent Australian history. And while the federal court ruled to reject Bruce Lehrman's claim against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson, few involved were left unscathed. The court found, on the balance of probabilities, Bruce Lehrman raped Brittany Higgins at Parliament House in 2019. Justin Quill represented Network 10 in the case.
His Honour's analysis on the facts and what occurred on that night could not have been more, it just couldn't have been better in my view.
Despite finding in 10's favour, Justice Michael Lee was highly critical of 10, especially over a speech given by Lisa Wilkinson at the Logies. But Justin Quill argues the publication of allegations against Mr. Lehrman was reasonable. Bruce Lehrman has always maintained his innocence.
If you just boil it down and you just simplify it to its absolute simplest terms, how could it be unreasonable to publish something that it was true? the central allegation was that a woman was raped in Parliament House in a minister's office.
Former New South Wales Supreme Court Judge Anthony Whealy does not believe the media should see the decision as a victory.
I think that the ethics of journalism have taken a terrible battering in this case. I think Channel 10 won this case by a whisker. It came down just to the last few sentences of a 324-page decision, and they managed to scrape across the line by the judge speculating, really, as to what Learman did or didn't do or had in his mind at the time the sexual encounter took place.
Sarah Aylward is from the law school at the University of Wollongong.
I'd be reluctant to consider this case as some kind of watershed moment for women's speech in this country. As I said, this is just one case. It's one judge. It's one set of evidence.
She believes there are lessons for other cases in Justice Lee's approach.
What was particularly surprising and really heartening to see was the trauma-informed approach that Justice Lee took to Ms. Higgins' evidence and to her courtroom testimony, and that really provided the foundation for her account to be believed, which then founded the truth defence.
Despite Bruce Learman losing the case, Dr. Aylward worries about the impact of Australia's defamation laws on women speaking out.
I think it's important to emphasise as well that this is an issue that doesn't just affect high-profile defamation cases, such as the one we've just seen. This is an issue that affects many women who seek to speak out about the violence that they have experienced. So, for example, at the moment, our defamation laws do not provide protection for women who wish to report experiences of sexual harassment and sexual violence to their employers. And it has become commonplace now for a woman who is lodging such a report or a complaint to then have the alleged perpetrator lodge a defamation claim against her as a way of silencing her.
Bruce Learman's criminal trial collapsed in 2022 due to juror misconduct, and no findings were made against him. An ACT government spokesman says any decision to progress criminal proceedings lies with the ACT's Director of Public Prosecutions.
That's Alexandra Humphreys. The youth curfew in Alice Springs has been lifted after almost 3 weeks. The measure was put in place after a spike in violence and juvenile crime. But is enough long-term support in place for young people at risk and also the wider community? Catherine Liddell is the CEO of SNAKE, which is the national peak body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and families.
The way we've all been looking at the curfew is it was part of a circuit breaker. So that's multiple things working all at once to give everyone a break. What we saw was a collision of extraordinary events. And I think the circuit breaker was well needed. I think people have had a chance to catch their breath. Everyone's now looking forward to how we move forward as a community and ensuring that we do absolutely have a real focus on community-driven medium and long-term approaches to our youth crisis.
What's in place so that there's not trouble tonight or tomorrow night or weeks or months down the track again?
Look, my understanding is during the curfew, of all the children that were interacted, and I'm speaking specifically for children here, all of those families, when approached about, you know, if we've picked up a child, all of them asked for help. And I guess this is where those requests for help are responded to. So this is where we're expecting government to ensure that the access to services is available. It isn't a silver bullet, but rather a lot of different solutions coming from a lot of different areas.
Do you think that an increased police presence, does that need to continue in Alice Springs at least for a while?
Look, I think on the ground, what we've found is the circuit breaker and the way the circuit breaker was responded to has made people feel secure. I think what's vital when we're looking at the police response is leaning into what the commissioner had to say when he said, police cannot arrest their way out of this. Police cannot do this on their own. Police will need to be working alongside community, and in particular with youth services. And more importantly, looking at the medium and long-term solutions, police need to be working with Aboriginal communities to create a pathway that brings Aboriginal people into the force, either as a police officer or as a form of auxiliary. And there was a recognition in that conversation that, you know, if you can't speak the language of the people that you're trying to communicate with, then you've got a fundamental problem. The only way to solve that is to make sure you are genuinely working hand in hand with community.
What do you think is the biggest misconception, the biggest misunderstanding about the reality of what's been unfolding in Alice Springs, in your view?
When you're looking at somewhere like Alice Springs, this didn't happen overnight. While we might have had a tipping point, it didn't happen overnight. It's happened over generations, and without a dedicated response that says, look, we've got to look at all layers of government, we've got to look at how we come together as a community, and we've got to come up with programs and services that can remain as a baseline regardless of election cycles. Until we can do that, we're always going to be looking for the next circuit breaker.
What about some support for those people who've been traumatised by being victims of this crime and what's been unfolding in Alice Springs?
Oh, look, anyone who's been a victim of crime deserves an outlet. You know, these things, there's a reason they're hot button topics. You know, it's because you have a visceral reaction. You have been scared. You have been terrified. So I would be hoping that, again, in the medium and long-term responses, the government is looking at different ways to ensure that the victims of crime themselves, and let me be clear, when we're talking about victims of crime, often the children and families you see on the streets are themselves victims of crime, have an outlet to speak, have an outlet to look for support, and genuinely have their concerns and their fears responded to.
That's Catherine Liddle there, CEO of SNAKE, which is the National Peak Body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Families. Scientists have been pointing it out for months, but now it is official. The US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has confirmed that there's been a fourth global mass coral bleaching event. It means that coral around the world is turning white and even dying as recent record ocean heat takes a devastating toll. The news highlights the need to address the root causes of climate change, particularly in our region. Today, business leaders, politicians and industry experts are gathering in Vietnam to discuss how the green economy, investment and trade can be promoted. Rachel Mealy reports.
Huge stretches of coral reef around the world have turned a ghostly white amid record warm ocean temperatures. Now, the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has confirmed what the world's scientists have known. A global bleaching event is underway. Coral scientist Dr. Neil Canton is from the Australian Institute for Marine Science.
It's pretty obvious that climate change is continuing to drive heat stress that coral reefs cannot cope with. The corals recovering and the new recruits into the communities are not adapting at a pace fast enough to keep up with the pace of climate change.
As the climate changes, events like this will become more frequent and intense, meaning there's an urgent need to decarbonise economies around the world. This week, Australian and Vietnamese leaders are coming together in the Vietnamese city of Ho Chi Minh to figure out how they can better cooperate on this. Among them is Australia's Assistant Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Jenny McAllister. Anna Scarbeck is the Chief Executive of Climate Works Centre at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute.
It's an opportunity for Australian and Vietnam businesses to understand green growth opportunities and Vietnam's readiness and potential to be a major contributor in the green energy transition.
The summit comes a month after Australia and Vietnam signed a strategic partnership to strengthen climate, environment and energy cooperation. Martine Letts is the chief executive of AsiaWorks. She says Australia and Vietnam are natural allies on this mission.
But Vietnam has very ambitious clean energy targets. Just like Australia, we share some very strong and shared challenges. Vietnam is also a very strong and growing manufacturing nation, which is still reliant on coal for much of its energy source. So helping Vietnam identify a pathway to clean energy to support its manufacturing sector and its economic growth is an important component in this particular summit.
She says Australian businesses in the renewable sector are optimistic about the future in Vietnam and Southeast Asia.
There's always going to be a difficult path between declared ambitious targets and actually getting to that destination. But the policy settings, both within Australia and Vietnam, are such now that businesses are reporting that they're they're optimistic about the future ahead.
Last year, the Australian government announced a $100 million aid package for sustainable infrastructure planning and private investment in clean energy infrastructure in Vietnam.
That's Rachel Mealy. And that's all from The World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was a judgment watched closely across the country as Justice Michael Lee meticulously outlined his ruling in the defamation case brought by Bruce Lehrman, leading to a dramatic finding against the former Liberal staffer that on the balance of probabilities, he raped Brittany Higgins. Today, we step through the civil judgment with court reporter Patrick Bell. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.